Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Plodcast, presented by sportsshoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Plodcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back, guys. This week we spoke to British ultra runner Tom Evans. Tom recently finished third at the UTMB Mont Blanc in a really impressive time of 20 hours and 34 minutes. And he's also pretty handy on the short distances as well. Sub 14 5K guy, sub 30 10K guy. Enjoy.
Hey, guys. Welcome back to another week on the podcast. Thanks for tuning in once again. As Lum said, Tom Evans this week. What an episode. Something a little bit different, an event which is a little bit different, an athlete who's a lot different to what we've been used to on the podcast. So I hope you enjoy it just for that, really. I mean, I found it truly fascinating. If you do have like an interest in endurance sports as well, even marathon running, half marathon running, there's some huge advice on training, how Tom manages to virtually stay injury free his whole career. He had a fascinating story as well. He was an officer in the army, dropped out of that to kind of pursue a career in ultra running. And this was dating back 5-6 years ago when ultra running was nowhere near as big as it is now. And, you know, here he is now getting third in UTMB, which is probably, you know, the holy grail of ultra running. It's probably the biggest race of the year, every year. So, you know, he talks about the scale of events that he's done. He's done 251K races, you know, 100 mile, which is UTMB, you know, above 2,000 meters of altitude. Unbelievable. Western States, 15 hours, again, 100 mile race. So lots of interesting stories. And he's actually got a really, really good science background. He really knows his stuff. He guinea pigs on himself all the time, tests, you know, how much carbohydrates and stuff to take. And he's just a very, very knowledgeable guy. And it just makes for a really good podcast. I think there's lessons to be learned, whatever event, whatever discipline you do, and whatever kind of angle you come at into this sport. So enjoy the podcast. And look, we're going to see more of Tom. He broke a few rumors to us that we might see him on the country again, maybe at Liverpool, MK Cross Challenge as well. So, but yeah, thanks for tuning in once again. And we'll catch you next week. And I hope everyone, if you were at the road relays, had a good weekend.
Right, Tom, first off, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on. How are you, first of all? Like, how's your little rest slash kind of introduction back into running treating you?
Yeah, guys, thanks so much for having me. Massive fan of the pod. I don't know when I raced. Coming up to 3.5 weeks ago now. And yeah, first week is nothing at all. It's hobbling to make a cup of tea feels like you're doing a session. Week two, I then did a bit of biking, and then after that, it was just a little bit of running, but just zero structure, maximum of whatever I felt like. If I got 10 minutes out the door and was a bit tired, I turned around, but actually I was all right this time. But I frustratingly fractured my finger during the race. So I was sort of in and out of A&E getting x-rays on it and then speaking to docs about it, because I'm no hand model, but I didn't want a sort of crooked finger for the rest of my life. So thankfully that was all right. And then body feels amazing. Like, I'm sure we'll talk about it in more detail, but like, I had pretty major knee surgery last year, and that's just been I can't believe that it feels great. I've never got through a long race and it's felt great afterwards. So that's been good. I had a bit of a sore foot. Having been injured after having a bit of a sore something, I had it scanned and it was all fine. I was just being pathetic basically, but I'm in the fortunate position. I say fortunate position. I paid for it. Where I can make those choices and be like, oh, okay, well, actually, I'll go get a scan just to be safe. So, yeah, I'm good now. Just slowly getting back into training with Soph, my fiance. She prepares for her sort of the end of their triathlon season before they build up to the world champs. And yeah, I get married in a month and a half. So
wow.
Yeah, that's taking quite a lot of effort. Yeah, that's harder than training. So yeah, I'm very well.
Because she's training, you having to pull your weight a little bit more in that department?
Yes, especially because I was away for so long building up to Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc. I was away for 16 weeks in 20-week period. Plus racing earlier this year, spending a couple of weeks in the locations in Gran Canaria and then in Madeira before, and in Vienna. So yeah, I took a bit of a back seat while things were happening, and yeah, now it's sort of all hands to the pump, and all the big stuff is done, but it's sort of the small tweaks that take the time. But yeah, this is it's great fun, but it's nice to be able to do something outside of running to keep me a little bit busy while volume isn't particularly high.
Well, look, let's talk about the trail scene a little bit, because many, you know, our podcast is pretty much distance focused. When I say distance focused, you know, 5, 10 Ks and middle distance and stuff on the track. So you're our first ultra runner we've had on the podcast, but you're a nice crossover because you kind of know the distance scene quite well as well. But for people who don't know, talk about the trail scene. I mean, the elephant in the room, your phenomenal exploits at, you know, Ultra Trail Mont Blanc. Kind of talk about maybe your season this year and what the races mean, because there is a World Series as well, isn't there?
Yeah, geez, it's so difficult. It's not, it's incredibly frustrating because there is no overarching governing body to the sport. An ultra, for any of you who don't know, an ultra marathon is just anything longer than a marathon. So it could be 50K, it could be 250K, it could be a multi-stage race, it could be a single stage race. Like, it doesn't, there's no differentiation. Whereas running a marathon is running a marathon. Yes, you'll get trail marathons, but a Boston and a London, yes, there might be some hills, but it's the same distance. Unless you run at Brighton, and then you're lucky because you run short.
Tim Hutchins on the podcast once, so he won't be listening.
how that can happen, I feel so sorry for the athletes. It's not their fault. It's basically anything longer than a marathon, and there are some flatter trail races, there are then some mountain trail races. So you could do a 100-mile race that might take the winners 15 hours in one race, and then the exact same field, it will take them 20 hours. So you're doing a third more of the time for exactly the same distance. So yeah, it's pretty different. In the UK, there is a bit of a scene. It is growing, which is really exciting, but we've just not got the real estate. We've not got the big mountains compared to the Alps. So it's a very European sport, and typically the Europeans have dominated the sport by doing winter sport, ski mountaineering, cross-country skiing, Nordic skiing in the winter, that then transfers across to trail running in the summer. And which is super interesting, looking at like their off season, they're still training like mad, but it's all cross-training, but it's specific cross-training, because ski mountaineering, cross-country skiing is almost identical to running, but with no impact. Whereas obviously that's something that we don't have access to in the UK, and occasionally around Battersea Park you'll see people using roller skis and you just stare at them thinking, what on earth are you doing? But actually the best trail runners in the world are doing that, and that's there. Yes, they're doing it on snow, but it's almost the same thing, and it makes complete sense. I've not got a set of roller skis, but I could be tempted. So yeah, I guess that's it. Yes, and that then sort of comes on to, there is a World Championships where you can compete for Great Britain, but it doesn't...
It's not as big as...
No.
Yeah.
It's not. The biggest races are Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc and UTMB World have been bought by Ironman, and now they are trying to take over like Ironman did 20 years ago, whereas there is still in triathlon, there is still a long course World Championships, which isn't owned by Ironman. It's not being privatized. So it's really difficult. So because it's very difficult to get all the very best runners at the same race in the same year. because people have want to do different things, and you take the world championships in Thailand later this year, I've had a look at the field and I don't recognize 98% of the names on the list. Whereas I look through the UTMB top 60 ranked athletes and I've heard of 99% of them. So it's really interesting. And I think, the sport is still massively in its intimacy and it is growing. And I think we'll fast forward this in a couple of years. And I think the sport will have grown, and whether having a overriding governing body will be a good thing or a bad thing for the sport, who knows? But I think that is the way that it's going. Otherwise, barriers to entry are just lifted too much because things get expensive, because it's just these races, all they want to do is make money. And they don't care about the athletes. Whereas, if there is an overriding governing body or an athlete-led advisory group, which there currently isn't, then it makes it far more easier access for people to get into, better control, and just safer for the athletes.
Mate, just on, we're going to get to how you started out, but just on the entries then, because is there a physical entry as well as, a financial? Surely people, have to pay, I presume, quite a large sum to enter these races. And then is there like a physical requirement as well?
Yeah, so you've got to have experience for these races. So I feel really sorry for some race directors who have signed up to this, to the UTMB scheme. They have to pay loads of money to UTMB for it to be an official UTMB race. And you then collect points for doing those that then put you then into a lottery for the big races at UTMB. But people will go to these smaller races to just get the points, but they won't be fit. They won't be ready because it's just a box ticking exercise. They've just got to finish. So it then becomes quite dangerous. And I then feel really sorry for the race organizers because they've got these inexperienced people who are just doing it because they want to race in these incredible races, and that it's great, but you still need to have some experience. And cost wise, I think an entry to Ultra de Mont Blanc for the 100 miler is, I think it's like €350. Mm. The entry to Marathon de Sable is like €4,500. Mm. And you get nothing. Like, you've got to carry all your own food. You get a tent. Yes, if things go wrong, you want the support there. But if things go really wrong, you've got to pay for your own helicopter. So I don't really know what you're paying for. It is expensive, but all these races sell out. So when people ask, like, the sort of classic phrase of how much does something cost, it's, well, the price that people are willing to pay. Mm-hmm. And because there's no governing body, these races are getting more and more expensive, but every race is selling out. So who's the, where do you go? It's so difficult.
Yeah. Now, it is a crazy different world to what we're kind of used to in your kind of more conventional distance running. As someone who Matt mentioned earlier is very much a crossover athlete, you compete anything from like 5K up, really. How do you like just describe yourself as a runner to like people asking, do you say I'm an ultra runner or you're just a distance runner who does everything?
I think now, so more an ultra runner. I think without turning this into sort of too much of a business spiel, you've got to define who you are. And I think by jumping in and out of things makes it, you blur the lines of your personality and exactly who you are. And will I still run shorter races? Yes. Am I planning on running shorter races in Cardiff, Milton Keynes and Liverpool this year? Yes. I won't tell you which ones they are, but they're about 10K. And do I want to do well in them? Yes. Mm. But for me, it's just great training and it's a great opportunity. And I think it's what I love about the running scene in the UK is that it doesn't really matter. You can throw your hat in the ring. And I think there are lots of athletes who don't like doing lots of races because they don't want a 20th place to come up on their power of 10. Whereas for me, because my ultra running doesn't go on power of 10, it doesn't really matter. If I finish 50th in a race in Cardiff, great. If you finish top five, great. Like it's a great training run. I get to, yeah, push myself. And yeah, I think that's a great thing about sort of the UK distance running scene.
Yeah. And how normal is that for an ultra runner to kind of compete in those shorter events?
I think we're seeing more and more of the top tier athletes doing it. You take sort of the greatest at the moment and probably for the last 10 years, Kilian Jornet. He races shorter races. He's raced a couple of 10Ks recently, but will race like 30K races and win them. And then a month later, turn it around and win the most competitive 100-mile race. So it is done. And then before the US Olympic trials, Jim Walmsley, who lots of people have heard of, he did some half marathons and then the Olympic trials. And I'm sort of kind of doing the same thing sort of for the longer scene. So I think it's not particularly common, but I think it's becoming more and more common as the guys who are finishing on the most prestigious podiums are almost sort of laying the foundations to say, look, you don't have to stay in your own lane. You can kind of fluctuate and flutter about depending on the sort of phase of periodization that you're in with your training. Like for me, my big race next year is a 100-miler that will hopefully take in and around 14 hours, which is still long. But I've got to, in order to do well at that, I've got to be able, my lactate threshold, my LT1 has to be good. I have to be able to 6-minute mile for 40 miles. Running 3:45 for 4.5-5 hours.
Wow.
In order to really put your hat in the ring. And in order to do that, you've got to be able to run 29-minute 10K. And in order to do that, you've got to be able to run 13 high 5K. And in order to do that, you've got to be able to run 2:40K. So it all filters back. And I think, using the same sort of psychology and the same physiology that when you see 800-meter runners step up to 1500 meters, yes, it's not that. You sit from the outside and you say, it's not that much of a difference. But actually, it is a pretty big difference, but the fundamentals are all still exactly the same.
Well, this is the thing. You talk about, you know, 50K, then 100 miles. That's a huge, you know, difference in range and a step up in distance. But is it actually as different as it might look on paper and a numerical value?
To be completely honest, I don't think so. I think for all of these races, you've obviously got to have a big foundation and in order to do well, you have to have a big foundation and a big aerobic base.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like the iceberg underneath the water. And I've built that up from years of team sport, being in the military, high volume training, training camps, running 100 milers, running multi-stage races. So I then, after a couple of weeks of sort of what I would call winter training, base training, I can then really then go and do the specificity, that sort of iceberg, the peak of the iceberg, and be able to, have good results, because I can just focus solely on 10K for 6 weeks and I can put out am I ever going to be the best in the UK? No. But can you finish top five? Well, it's what I did for cross country in 2019. Like I raced 100 miler in end of June and then qualified for European cross country champs in November and I had a knee injury in between. So using that theory and that example, like the base endurance, it doesn't disappear. Yes, if you did nothing for a year, it would. But as long as you keep it slightly turning over in the background, then I think you can just add that specificity onto it. And I think for me, like people ask, oh, why don't you live in the mountains? Because you can train specifically the whole time. I'm like, well, you don't really need to. If you're training for a marathon, you're not constantly marathon training. Like you mix things up. And the people who just run marathons and say, oh, marathon after marathon after marathon, their performances just get worse and worse and worse. And it's so obvious to see, and it's so sad to see, because it's like, well, come on, you need to just take a little bit of time. And then you look at athletes who could go and do that. You take Jake Smith, for example, who I saw the other day. I think the best, he is the most, in my opinion, by far the most exciting young British talent for endurance coming through. He could make any team now for a marathon easy. But by him taking things slowly, it's just making him a way, way better athlete, and will be able to do it for a longer term. And I wish when Callum Hawkins was his age, he did a similar thing, because it's so sad seeing the talent that Callum is in his, he's in his prime years now, and he's been sidelined through injury. And you've got to think, is by doing back-to-back-to-back marathons, is that sensible? It's the same with ultra running. By doing 100 miler after 100 miler after 100 miler, you're just going to get slower. You're going to get burnt out. You're probably going to get injured. And in order to get, in order to reach your potential, you have to be consistent. And I don't think for him, for me, consistency isn't measured in sort of days or weeks, not even months. Consistency is measured in years. And I think in order to really, yeah, unlock whatever your endurance capability is, you've got to go for a long time. And just by the very dictionary definition of endurance, to be able to do something difficult for a long period of time, it's basic. Like the definition of endurance tells you you've got to do it for a long time. So you try and stick an amazing 12-week training block together. That's great. But in the grand scheme of things, that's doing nothing. Like you might peak for a race, but it's not good. That's not laying the foundation. That's sort of just building something little, and then you'll lose it as quick as you gained it. So yeah, I think just for me, sort of just taking my time and being able to have fun with running as well. And I'm now in the stage of my career where going to a race is, yeah, I get a bit nervous. It's a bit stressful, because in the pre-race favorites, you're near the top, and that's it's a great place to be in, but you're either going to do well and finish on a podium or you're not. And for me, I can go to a cross country race or a 5K or a 10K. No one really expects anything from you. Yes, they might know who you are, but they probably won't. They'll say, oh, who's this guy? He's just rocked up. Someone in full Adidas kit. He's probably bought that online. what an idiot. And yeah, I'll either do well and surprise people and say, oh wow, yeah, that's that guy. Or I'll finish 50th and people will be like, oh, well, that's kind of what we expect. You just ran 100 miles. So for cross country, I can only exceed my expectations, because I've got no idea. And that's great. And that's fun.
Jeez, so many questions off the back of it. But I guess this is quite a good place to kind of move to your training for these events. You've kind of touched upon it a little bit, but you know, you've stayed relatively injury free. I know you had that one serious injury through COVID. But like you say, you must be clocking serious mileage all the time, pretty much all year round. And how have you stayed injury free? And, you know, how do you prepare for such events?
I think, that's such a good question. I think part of me thinks that people expect you to say, oh yeah, I run 250K a week, week in, week out. And I think for me, I love Strava. I mean, it's great. But everyone on Strava thinks you need to have like a build up and then just perfectly flat mileage the whole time. And it's like, it's as if we've forgotten what a deload week is. It's like, you can't do that. So, and there was some meme that came up on Instagram or Twitter in the summer of like, you know, something's going wrong when your Strava looks like the Patagonia logo and it's like this the whole time. And mine's, it's not that to the same extent, but yeah, this the whole way, because yes, my biggest weeks are 30 hours in the mountains, but running in the I live in Loughborough. If I was to run for 30 hours in Loughborough, I average 6:30. Yeah, there'd be a lot of the 2K loop. So I could not do 30 hours of running in Loughborough. So I end up cross training a lot when I'm at home. I don't really like running more than 120 115 miles in Loughborough and whatever, and I'll then add up, I might then do 10 hours on the bike during the week. But if I'm in the mountains training specifically for these races, a lot of it's hiking. It takes much longer. It might take you 5 hours to do 20 miles, whereas in Loughborough, it's going to take you hour 55. So yeah, it is very different. So yeah, I do train high volume. I'm fortunate enough to be full-time. So I take the recovery very seriously, and recovery isn't, I mean, a lot of is the question I get asked, one of the most is, oh, what's your best recovery tool that you've got? My mattress is the best. Like it's sleep and sleep. Like I try and nap at least every other day, and it's a proper, it's a 2 hour job that it takes time. None of these, yes, using a massage gun, there's some science suggesting that it might be helpful. Using recovery boots, there's some science that it might suggest to be helpful, but you actually look at the science and who it's funded by and you're like, ah, it was funded by the company that are selling these devices. But then you look at sleep and you're like, okay, well, sleep is, you look at any research, sleep is where we recover. So yeah, I think sleep's been a huge thing. And I think just being a bit more sensible, and I do a little bit of coaching, and you get athletes who will say, oh yeah, I've got this bit of a niggle, but I think it's all right. I'm just going to crack on. It's like, take a day or take 2 days, just take a week off now, monitor it. Don't, if anything is painful, you shouldn't be doing it, especially in a sort of an early stage of a training block. Yes, take some risks at some point. But yeah, I guess my mentality at the beginning of the year, and that to a certain extent for the whole of the year, wasn't a question of how much training can I do? What can I push myself to? It was what is the minimum amount of training I can do in order to achieve my goals? You can always do more with everything. If you've got a project at university, you can always spend another hour on your dissertation. But there comes a point where you go beyond sort of diminishing returns, and it's just not helping. So yeah, I do a little bit of strength work in my off season, especially if I'm not running on the trails. When I'm running for more than 15 hours a week on the trails, strength training completely drops out of conventional strength training drops out of my program, because I'm climbing 10,000 meters a week, which is a shed load. And that's enough to strengthen things. And if things aren't strong, you're going to know about it. You're going to have to take time off the trails.
Will you set, I mean, like many people set kind of almost weekly mileage targets, will you set, you know, weekly climb targets then during that period as well? Yeah,
exactly. So depending on what race I'm building up to, I will always try and run a very similar ratio of distance to elevation gain. So for something like Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc, that was 100 miles with 10,000 meters of climbing, it was okay. So for every 10 miles in training I run, I need to climb 1,000 meters. Mm. Around Loughborough, it was possible, seriously boring, but it was possible. but yeah, for me, that's sort of that's a ratio that I like to use. And when you're training specifically, when you're in the mountains, it's so easy. But yeah, I'm in Loughborough. For me, I go to the Peak District 2, maybe 3 times a week to train, so I can get some decent elevation without having to just constantly go up and down. Because by doing that, you get really slow. And you've got to be able, for me, my strength is my relative speed. I don't want to lose it. I've got to keep doing it. So yeah, I get, and that's sort of my methodology of training. I have at least one day of not running a week. And on that day, yes, I might ride for a bit, but it's dependent on how I feel. Like, I think training programs are great, and I've got a coach and he's amazing. But sometimes you've got to take extra rest. And I think when the big problem, I think, that people find is when training's going really well, they want to do more and they get greedy and you start snatching at things. And like in anything, when you start trying to snatch for things, that's when you drop things. And I think it's the worst. And you see it so often, people sort of will have a really good race result. They'll be super motivated afterwards. They think, oh, this is amazing. I just got to keep training, keep training, keep training. And it's, that for me is sort of the first warning signs of it might work for a month. It might work for 6 weeks, but there's going to become a point where it's not possible to do anymore. So yeah, I think I've got way less greedy with my training over the last year. And I think it took a serious injury to do that. And like when I say a lot of the time, and I used to sort of, it would be sort of do as I say, not as I do. Mm. Whereas now, like after being injured, I had to take my own advice and be like, right, you need a rest day a week. Yes, you might do something. Yes, you might go out on the bike for 5 hours, but you're not putting sort of mechanical load through your body. Yes, you might be knackered because you've done 5 hours on the bike, but it's different to running.
Mm. Well, it is a mind-boggling amount of training, isn't it?
And it is a lot. It is boring.
You mentioned your coach then. You coach by Andy Hobble, is that right?
No, I coach by a guy called Scott Johnson in the US.
But you mentioned you have a coach, but it sounds like you have a lot of influence over what you do. How does that relationship work then?
I guess if you looked at it in like a business sense, he'd probably be more of a consultant than a coach. Yes, he looks at my training and we speak a lot. We speak pretty much WhatsApp daily, a call every week or every other week or whenever we need to. And this is how I feel today. And everything's analyzed, but not overanalyzed. I've been on training camps where seeing a particular athlete will go through with his coach in the morning and look at his sleep data and, oh, you didn't sleep that well. Well, we'll actually change a session. And for me, it's like that's taking it maybe a little bit too far. But then, yeah, it's if I feel good, we'll go with this plan. And I guess it's just, yeah, every bit of training serves a purpose. And if it's taking me a step closer to the goal that I've set myself, then great. And if it's not, it's then questioning, well, why are we doing this? Why am I doing, I'm training, let's say, a 25-hour volume week. Why am I going out and doing this easy recovery run? You're not recovering because you're knackered. You're just putting more strain on your body. And geez, I could count on one hand the amount of double run days I've done in the last 12 months. And I'm aerobically the fittest I've ever been. Is that because I'm recovering better between sessions? And I think that's a lot of people get into their head that, oh, because some athletes are doing this, it works. But then at the same time, there's a lot of athletes who are not doing it and it also works. So yeah, I think just taking things on like an individual basis and yeah, it's been really interesting working with Scott, who is used to be pretty much solely just a ski coach. Mm-hmm. But very based on Canova's principles. We basically take Canova's principles and put it into the mountains. And it works. Obviously, Canova's an absolute boss. Mm-hmm. So it's been super interesting and huge believer of cross training, huge believer of strength work when we're not spending that much time on the trails. Our training isn't rocket science. It's sensible. Yes, we'll push the envelope at points. And I think my biggest week of volume, I did a 36-hour run week in the summer is my biggest week. But before that was a 29-hour week, and after it was a 20-hour week, so a proper deload week. Yes, it's still a lot of training, but it's all relative. It's just training really sensibly. Go on how you feel. If you feel something, stop or make a proper decision. Like have that sort of take a step back and be like, right, something's uncomfortable. What is it? Is it something that is going to go, or do we need to put an intervention into place to make it work? And I think for me, it's that ability to make that decision quickly, that if it is something, then you can get it fixed and get it sorted. But I had an Achilles problem 6 weeks before UTMB, and I didn't run for 10 days, 6 weeks before my main, my biggest race of the year, the race that I've been preparing for 12 months. I think you, at that point, you could really panic and think, oh no, actually I have to keep training. Well, and everyone would say, oh, it's better to turn up, sort of the old wives' tale of, it's better to turn up on the start line, a little bit less fit, but injury free. But everyone ignores it because you think, oh, I have to train. You don't lose anything in a week. Yes, if you're an 800 meter runner and you didn't run for 10 days before the Olympic semifinals, you'd struggle. But for actual endurance, 10 days is nothing. If you've trained for 5 years consistently, 10 days is nothing. So yeah, I think it's just being more sensible.
What about your mentality, man? You talked about, you mentioned it earlier, being a little bit boring. These crazy hours you put in. What goes through your head, you know, during races, you know, during all these training runs? How do you just keep yourself going?
Racing is super easy. Racing is, there are eyes on you. There are people cheering. There are people tracking you. Racing is so easy. I could do a 20-hour race and I wouldn't get bored. My mind wouldn't wander. It's easy. I will do some training runs here on an easy day where I go for, it's a 45-minute easy run and I hate it and I really struggle and I'll get 15 minutes in, I need a pee, I'll stop for a pee and I'll just be thinking, why on earth am I doing this? Like, this is so hard. How am I ever going to run for 20 hours? And for those runs, you kind of know it's going to happen and you procrastinate before and you're like, oh, I'll just have one more coffee or, oh, I'll just watch another half an episode on Netflix. And then that turns into an episode. And then you're like, oh, actually, I've got a bit of time. I'll do another one. And then like, oh, I've got a call. Oh, I'll just do the run afterwards. And you just procrastinate through. Like, we're lucky enough. We've got dogs. I'll run with the dogs if I really don't want to run. I listen to music if I really don't want to run. I typically don't listen to music if I'm training. I use it as like a, yeah, as a bit of a stimulant if I really don't want to go and I just need to distract myself. Or I listen to podcasts, or quite a lot we've done, like we'll do like point to point runs. You've got no option.
Yeah.
Like I'm being picked up. Soph will do a 4-hour ride in the Peak District and she'll drop me off on one side. I've got to get to the other side. And it's like, right, she's going to be finished in 4 hours. I've got 25 miles to do. There's no public transport. I can't take the easy option. I have to do this. And then I think having a reason why, having like a really strong, like, why am I doing this? And I understand the reasons why I'm doing this because it's taking me one step closer to the goal that I've set in a specific way. Cool, 4-hour run, great. Well, actually, we're going to do this completely fasted and we're going to see what happens to my body after 4 hours at 7-minute miling. With no food, no fuel, no breakfast, have a bit of water, see what happens. Because that science, that data doesn't really exist. And if it did exist, it's so dependent on the person. So going around with glucose monitoring, with lactate, with heart rate, with core body temp, seeing what these things do and using yourself as a bit of a guinea pig, because let's collect this science now so we can use it in training and at a later date. Because, and for me, that serves a purpose. So it's easy to do. It's thinking, right, I can't take the easy route now because in 4 months' time when I actually really need this data, if I've not got it, well, you kind of just let yourself down.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've let your...
Yeah, sorry. How crucial is that come race day? You know, figuring out this data because, you know, in a race and talk through how many carbs you took on, how much protein, because I think I saw an interesting stat on that.
Yeah, so I think it's super important. And it's great having a plan, but as everyone knows, in anyone who's done a half marathon and above, the plan, sometimes it works, but sometimes it has to be adapted and sometimes it has to be completely changed. And for me, by doing training so much and training such high or relatively high volume, you go through all of this in training. There'll be days that you do run 40 miles and you can try all of these things like, oh no, that isn't good, or actually, oh, that felt great. So I think typically people used to go off like 70 grams of carbs an hour is sort of the sweet spot. And I think what cycling has shown, and yes, cycling, it's significantly easier to absorb carbohydrate because your stomach isn't going up and down. But we've done training runs taking like 120 grams of carbohydrate an hour for 4 or 5 hours. And for me, taking on that much, there was no performance gain. And it was actually working out, right, what is the least amount of carbohydrate I can afford to take while not dipping in performance? So we tried at 120. We tried at 110. And actually, my sweet spot was in and around 90. It was between like 85 and 100 grams. So we're like, right, 90, super easy number. So yeah, I sort of looked to take in 90 grams of carbs an hour, every hour from the start. And that's a mixture of like actual food, sports drink. Like I use Morton for hydrogel, and Morton bars and gels and drink mix. And then we do a lot of sort of research into caffeine use as well. I'm a huge believer in caffeine, and I'll 2 weeks before a race, I'll sort of completely go cold turkey on caffeine. And then I then start taking in the race. And with that sort of a combination of Red Bull and Morton. And that's really good. But I've done a 6 hour treadmill test to see what my caffeine metabolic rate is, because everyone's, caffeine's got a half-life of 6 hours. Well, that's great, but your metabolism, you will metabolize caffeine quicker or slower than I will. Yours might be 3 hours, mine might be 6 hours. You need to take a lot of caffeine in order for it to affect your performance. And I think for me, because ultra running doesn't going back to the whole governing body, because there isn't the money going into it. Mm. It's all being privatized. This data doesn't exist. And I think sort of for me, there are a couple of athletes who really are at the forefront of collecting this data. You see it in triathlon. You look at the Norwegians in triathlon who are just crushing it, because they've been collecting this data for the last 3, 4, 5 years. And they're now at the place where they can use it. Same with protein. I look to take not much, but about 5 grams of protein every 2 hours. That's in a drink as well. But about to be a bar, which is very exciting. That'll make my life much easier. I think I don't really take fat on during the run. It's not the healthiest sort of pre-race. Like I cut all fiber 3 days before the race. One, you get to race weight really quickly because, you do get to race weight quickly because you're carrying nothing in your stomach. You've still got the exact same body mass. You're just carrying less water. I think it's not rocket science. You've just got to be, and everyone says, don't do anything on race day that you don't do in training. Because I've got so long to train, I've got so long to practice these things, it makes it really easy. Whereas I think people who maybe don't do the required training for a marathon, they don't run a 20 miler at marathon pace or whatever it is, they don't have the opportunity to test things. So you take a risk and like, if this works for, this is what Kipchoge uses. What Kipchoge says he uses and what he actually uses, probably two different things. is very clever. These things sell. And for me, it's like some of the best, what's the difference between a jam sandwich and a gel in carbohydrate wise? Well, nothing. It's carbohydrate. If you're able to consume it and your stomach can deal with it, and we'll do runs where we just train our stomach, and it might be a really easy run, but it's like, right, well, let's have 2 minutes before you go, let's have a bar, and then 20 minutes in, let's have another bar, 40 minutes, let's have a gel. You don't need it, but you're just training your stomach to be able to deal with it and digest it. So come race day, when you actually need to take in that 90 grams of carbohydrate, that 90 gram isn't a guess. It's we have spent hours and hours and hours trialing this, that you then have full confidence, you take full responsibility that actually, if this goes wrong, it's no one else's fault. It's my fault. Same with shoes. I mean, shoes is such a great conversation to have with people, because yes, they do make a difference, and the technology has come on loads. But people saying, people about ultra running, they love talk about, oh, your feet must be really sore. It's like, well, no, not really. And if they are, it's got nothing to do with the shoe. It's got nothing to do with the sock. It's, I take 100% responsibility for everything, because I've got to test these things. If something's wrong, well, I need to change it. And I think being able to take that responsibility, so I know, and you ask yourself before a race, like, why am I going to DNF this race? What are the reasons I'm going to DNF? Right. Injury. Fine. Happy to take that. There's not much you can do about it. Nutrition is a huge one in ultramarathons. I think like 60% of DNFs come from stomach issues. Mm. I'm like, why? Like, this is a controllable factor that you can do so much preparation for. Yes, things happen on race day, but you do a race like Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc, where there's a section where you're going to spend 4 to 8 hours above 2,000 meters above sea level. Wow. At a higher altitude, your body demands more carbohydrate. So by saying, okay, well, yeah, I'm going to take 90 grams of carbs an hour, but actually doing that, you need to up it, because things are different. So yeah, I think going into that, and because there isn't this science, there isn't this research into ultra running, because there's not as much money as there is in cycling. So yeah, I guess I've taken loads of, yeah, the blueprint of a Tour de France cyclist, and we've modified it into how we can use it for running. And it's not revolutionary. It's just the data and the science is there. It's just, right, how can it work for my sport? And then how can it work for me inside that sport?
Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a lot of strategy going on that you've just chatted through, kind of pre-race. Within a kind of a race of that distance, how much tactics are there within the race itself? Or is it just a pure fitness thing?
I don't think it's a pure fitness thing at all. I think the tactics are all mental. Like, yes, there will be surges in the, like, there are surges in these 100-mile races, because some people will be better at the uphills, some people better on the flat, some people better on the downhills. And it doesn't matter if you're similar to a marathon. It doesn't matter if you're in the lead at 20 miles. It only matters who's in the lead when you cross through the tape. But yeah, I think it's more so those of mental tactics and those mental strategies. It's going to be hard for everyone. You'll have the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. And that might be in the space of 10 minutes. And I think, yeah, you've just got to be prepared. You go into the race knowing that there are bits that are really, really going to suck, and they're going to be really hard. And for me, it's almost when I get to that point, I think, well, great. Like, you knew this was going to happen. Like, you signed up to this race. This is out of pure choice. You knew it was going to be miserable at the time. So deal with it. And whether that's you take a caffeine gel, or at that point you might put some music on, or you think positive reinforcement, and or you get before a race, like, I might get my coach or my fiance to write a note that I don't look at, I don't read. It's in a tiny envelope, weighs nothing, that when things get really tough, I'll put it out and read it. Like, and it's those, right, it's a great distraction. And then it's okay, well, I'm not just doing this myself. Pull yourself together. It's only running. You're just, yes, it's hard, but this was a reason that you knew it was going to be hard. You've trained for it in the hard. And I think anyone who can train for endurance in the UK in the winter is mentally absolutely nails, because it's so miserable. And then when you get to do it in these beautiful places in the Alps, it's nice weather. Yeah, it's just great. Training is so much harder. And the mental aspect of ultra running, racing is easy. And people always sort of want to say, oh, like, in the race, it must be really hard. Like, you're thinking tactics. The race, I'm so relaxed. It's the most relaxed I am. You're just running. I'm just trying to get from A to B as quickly as I can. Yes, it might be 100 miles, but the concept is still exactly the same. And it's easy. Whereas it's those easy 45-minute training runs that the strategy and the tactics and that are, yeah, significantly harder, because you just take the easy option and you just say, I'll just watch Netflix instead. And I might do some core that you never do because, you do it on the lounge floor and you just lie there for a bit and you do a set or two and you're like, right, I'll go make myself a cup of tea and you finish.
It's literally me and you.
Yeah, I was going to say.
We've all been there, but it's the same for everyone. Like, it's just because you're a professional athlete doesn't mean it's great the whole time. If anything, you have more time to think about how miserable it's going to be. But you know why you're doing it. Yeah. And I think for me, like, geez, yes, I love training, but I'd find it very difficult to train well and as hard as I do, or as smart as I do, I should say, if I didn't have a goal and if I didn't know what I was working towards. And I think that's where a lot of people fail. And I think that's where a lot of people struggle with running is like, they'll do a couch to 5K or whatever, which is amazing. But then they do that. And then sort of the goal kind of stops. And it's then at that point, it's like, right, well, what excites you? What interests you? What's going to motivate you that in a British winter that you are going to go out and train? And actually, you know that, yeah, it might be raining outside and you've got an hour to do. Well, you know why you're doing it. It serves a purpose. There's nothing you can really replace it with. So you're like, right, well, I've kind of just got to do it. Mm-hmm. And you do it and you get 20 minutes in. And then you're like, okay, well, I'm 20 minutes in. I might as well just keep doing it because I've done 20 minutes. I've only got 40 left. And however miserable and tough it is, you've gone out and done it because come race day, it just means you'll be ready.
Yeah. You are professional now, of course, but that wasn't always the case. And you made quite a big career choice to, correct me if I'm wrong, but you left the army as an officer, which is something which takes, you know, quite a lot of commitment, quite a lot of time to reach. And you left to obviously pursue your dreams. Have you fulfilled your dreams?
Not yet, but I'm on my way. I think being in the military was amazing. I absolutely loved it. But I speak about consistency. And even at that point, I realized that consistency was super important. And geez, in the military, I didn't know what I was doing 3 days later, let alone 3 months. And my race calendar is now in pencil for the next 3 years. Wow. I know what I want to target. And yes, it will change. But I've got the next year is pretty set in stone. And then after that, I know what I want to do, but it might change a little bit. And with the military, I just couldn't do that. And I couldn't be consistent. And from speaking to other professional athletes or other people who were professional in their field, you've got to focus on it. If you really, really want to achieve something, you've got to be prepared to put all of your eggs in one basket. And it can be scary. And it was scary. Yet there was unknown for a while, but I was incredibly fortunate. The military was great. They said, right, I had to hand in my notice. And they said, right, well, we'll let you be a professional athlete until you leave, which was 8 months later. So my first 8 months as a professional athlete, I was still being paid by the army, which was insane. Yes, I had to do a little bit of work for the army, but 90% of the time I could do what I needed to do, which was incredible. And there's no way that I would have got the results that I needed to do to really become a established full-time athlete. That was incredible. And yeah, to then be able to sort of, yeah, transition into being a full-time athlete was pretty seamless because I had that eight-month buffer that if you didn't have, yeah, it would be incredibly scary because you're only as good as your last performance. And yeah, who knows? Running in professional sport is such that, yeah, you could be great. You could not be in with a sport like ultra running. You only race, it's like a marathon. You only race 3 times a year, roughly. If you have 3 bad days in 365 days,
yeah,
it could be a really bad year, or it could be an amazing year.
Where's that love come from then for ultra running? Like when did you realize that is exactly what you wanted to do?
I guess probably when I was at school. Like I was always very sporty, but I was never the best. I just tried the hardest. Elite sport and elite performance, elite soldiering. Like I always wanted to be the best version. Well, actually, that's a lie. I always wanted to be the best at everything I was doing, but I very quickly realized that that was impossible. You can't be the best at rugby and then the best at cross country the weekend after or the day after. Like However much you want to do that as a 17-year-old kid, you can't. And that, you can do it much better when you're 17. But as I got older and older, I sort of realized that the things that I wanted to be really good at might not be the things like I'm actually really good at. So it was sort of, yeah, I guess I sort of found it fairly organically. And I am a bit of a yes man, and I like challenging myself. And I signed up to Marathon des Sables because some friends did it in 2016. And when they got back, we went to the pub, had a couple of beers. I said, yeah, guys, I reckon I can do better than you did. Fast forward 12 months and I was there. Didn't have a coach, didn't do any sort of specific training. If I had an hour, I'd run for an hour. If I had 3 hours, I'd run for 3 hours. I had a really good race and finished on the podium. I was the first non-Moroccan man to finish on the podium in 32 years of the race, which just seems bonkers. Got the opportunity to do a couple more races after that and found out that I was good at it. I loved the training. I loved pushing myself. I loved testing myself. Yes, I love running. But for me, the thing that really interests me with trail running and ultra running is that strategy and that planning. Like, you do a 10K. Well, the only thing that really matters is the race itself. Like, you don't really need to worry about nutrition during the race. You don't really have to plan, or what if this happens? What if that happens? You're going at full gas for the whole thing. Whereas with a 20-hour race, there is so much planning. It's like a military operation. Like, it can be so complex, which is what I loved about it. It sort of became way more like three-dimensional compared to road running, which is why I ended up specializing in that. And like, part of me thinks, oh yeah, it would have been great to spend a bit more time on sort of focusing on the half marathon. And yes, I do want to run a good marathon. I've run one and it was horrendous because it was 4 weeks after a 100K race, which is stupid, but I wanted to do everything because I was fairly talented at a bit of everything. So I was like, oh, I reckon I can do this. I reckon I can run sub 220. And on the day I couldn't. And I found it incredibly hard. And yeah, the last 12K was absolute misery, but I put myself in that box and it was my fault. I guess sort of starting, I was sort of naive enough to start it and then stubborn enough to not stop. And I think that's what a lot of running is. Like, you're building a habit. You've got to be naive to start it because it is a bit of an unknown. And then you've just got to be stubborn, because there are going to be good times, there are going to be bad times, and you take the good with the bad and you roll with the punches, and you just got to be consistent. And I realize I've said consistent about 1,000 times on this podcast, but hopefully it reaches at least one person and think, maybe I won't go out this weekend and do the longest and fastest run I've ever done. I'll just build up slowly. Maybe. Or not. Or people might think, maybe he's telling fibs so I can do the exact opposite and I'll be maybe that's what I do. Maybe actually every run is a race.
Look, you've mentioned obviously being fortunate enough to be full-time and professional athlete. Like, talk about your sponsors and I guess they're the ones that enable you to do that. Like, talk about them and how they kind of help you.
Yeah, so the first professional contract I signed was with Red Bull. And I signed with Red Bull the day before my first big win, which for me is everything that you could ever dream that a brand would do, is support you before you've had a result. Mm-hmm. It's the brands who jump. So say again.
I said, and then hopefully you get some extra bonus then.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the brands who try and jump on after a good performance that for me are the ones that you've got to be worried about, because you want them at the highs and you want them at the lows. So yeah, Simon's Red Bull, and geez, they've been incredible. And it's the work they do behind the scenes that people don't realize. They are like a governing body almost. They pay for all of my medical that I need. they've got rehab centers in Austria that I've been to and I went with after my knee. You just genuinely get so well looked after, not just as an athlete, but as a person. Because at the end of the day, I am Tom. I'm a 30-year-old guy. Yes, I'm a runner, but that doesn't define who I am. And if I've got a project or an idea of something that I want to do, I can go to them and they'll be like, right, yes, but how do we do it? Let's make it work. And it's very collaborative and it's a partnership rather than like a sponsorship, which I think is amazing. Adidas Terex, so the sort of outdoor side of Adidas, used to sort of work, sort of Adidas running would be here and Adidas Terex would be here. And my sort of goal over the last couple of years is to get that a little bit closer. So the lessons that Adidas running have made in footwear now transcend to what Adidas Terex are doing. And we actually did some shoe testing 8 weeks ago now and used some prototype shoes of Adidas Terex against the current Adios Pro 3. And the Terex prototype was 8% more efficient than the Adidas road shoe, which is incredible for such a young brand. It's now the most efficient long distance running shoe is now a trail shoe. Yes, the shoe doesn't exist yet, but it will next year, which is super exciting. That's been an amazing journey. And I think the real difference between Adidas Terex and the other sort of competitor brands is the team. Yes, Adidas is a huge company, which is amazing because you've got that backing of, right, oh, I want to do loads of cycling. Cool. Well, here's some kit. Or yeah, I've got this idea. Well, someone's already done it before within the company, so we'll find a way to make it work. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that you can't buy is team spirit. And the way that the Adidas Terex team has been created is just, I don't know how they've done it, but everyone gets on, everyone's friends. Yes, you race against each other, but you're friends at the same time. Like, it's so nice, and it's genuinely so special. Garmin, who I've been with for a couple of years, and Garmin have shot themselves in the foot with the new Enduro 2, because as an ultra runner, I could not imagine anything else I would ever want on the watch. Like, it's got nothing.
They can stop.
Yeah. But it's like, you look at, and you take the other side of the coin of like Apple, they release something new every year and it's got a tiny upgrade. So people think, oh, I need to get this. But they've probably already got the science and the data and the technology to make the next one. But why make the best one? Because then no one else will need to buy it. You buy one and that's you happy. So Garmin are incredible. The tech's amazing. And it's so nice getting like the inside track and helping to develop these products of like exactly what I want and what I need. And there's some really exciting stuff coming in the near future, which is great. I signed with Sun God.
No, I was just going to say, just a question on Garmin. On race day, presumably it's pretty well mapped out, but it must be quite, you know, there are a lot of stories of people obviously going off course, going wrong. Do you ever use your Garmin to help navigate you?
Yeah, I do. I'll always put, yes, the routes are well mapped out, but I'll always put the GPX file onto my Garmin. And I actually break the GPX down, the file down into smaller bits. So for a 100-miler, it's normally four parts, so 25 miles, which, yes, it's still a long time, but it seems way more manageable when your watch says you've got 18 miles left rather than saying you've got 92 miles left.
Oh,
that's pretty depressing. And I think for me, especially running at night, using the Garmin, it's really good on climbs because you know exactly how long. Use the Climb Pro feature that tells you how much longer of the climb you've got in distance, elevation, and at your current pace,
right,
how long it's going to take, which is... it's super useful, especially in the dark. It's miserable at the best of times. So at least if you've got a bit of companionship by your watch, which is mad, which is so good. yes, they've been amazing. And yeah, I signed with Sun God in the summer for the glasses. I've tried every different glasses company that I can imagine, and I dread to think how many sunglasses we've got at home. I just can't get over the lens quality. The adaptability of the photochromatic lenses, you can actually see. And especially with trail running, you might go from an open area into the woods, and it goes from being really bright to really dark, and just like that, it flicks.
Wow.
And you can actually see, like, it's like watching, it's like going to your parents' house and watching TV and then coming home and you've got then got this like massive, like proper decent 8K TV. And your parents have got some like old terrestrial thing, and there's still like wires coming out the top. I didn't, when the first conversation I had with Sungod, I was like, oh yeah, but you guys would say this because it's your product. And they're like, oh, dude, just try it. Let us know what you think. And yeah, straight afterwards, you're like, this is just a game changer. And yeah, that's about it. I then get supported by companies like Morton, which have been really cool seeing their people sort of think, oh, Morton, they've not got many products. Like, it's a gel, or it's two gels, a drink mix of two different sizes and a bar. You guys just wait. It's super exciting. And we've been, I'm on sort of the product development and testing team, which is really cool. So I've been using a product for the last 12 months, which comes out later this year. Which a complete game changer, which it would be super exciting. Then there's a couple of other products coming out next year, which is really cool. Still keeping like, the super high quality, but giving athletes what they need, that 360 degree approach. That's probably about it. Hopefully I haven't missed anyone.
Look, you've already listed quite a few there. I mean, my next question was going to kind of be is, do you think the market you're in, the ultra trail scene, is it more lucrative than the current distance climber? Or is it just because you simply are one of the best? And if you look at one of the best middle distance runners in the world, they're going to have a lot of sponsors and probably earn quite a lot of money.
I think the amount of money is in trail running is less. Like, I make a decent living, but I'm not for winning. Yeah, I finished third at UTMB, which is the equivalent of Diamond League final.
Yeah.
From UTMB, the race itself, I got €1,000.
Wow.
Which is mad for a 20-hour race. Bonkers. Bonkers. Wow. Seeing as the race entry for each, they had 3,500 people racing and it's £350 a pop. €350. So bonkers.
Mm.
But thankfully, my sponsors are amazing. I make a decent living there. I think trail running is growing so much because so many people have now done marathons.
Yeah,
that it's now, it's what the question is, what's next? It's either I want to travel a bit and I've done London. Now I want to go and do one of the American ones. I want to go do New York or Boston. Or it's now I've done a marathon, but yeah, you either go fast or you go longer. You go longer, that's you go to ultra running. And yes, there are ultra running races on tracks and on roads, but this sounds horrendous. They're not as Instagrammable.
it's surely just not as enjoyable either. I mean,
it's not as enjoyable, but you don't get the kudos from doing it. You don't get the amazing pictures doing it. And I think in the digital and social media world, like you see so many people posting pictures of their runs in London or whatever, and it will be let's do it in this place because this looks the nicest. Like we've actually just run through a housing estate and some shops and there's loads of rubbish and it's a bit grim, but there is this one small space. So we'll just run up and down it three times.
Yeah.
Whereas you go out on the trails, you can literally take a picture anywhere and it's incredible. So I think that's definitely a factor of it being commercial, because I think the thing that people love and that I love is it doesn't really, it's not stressful. It doesn't matter. Like I don't have a set pace. If I'm going for an easy run or I'm going for a run on the trails, I don't have a set pace. I'll just go on effort. So you're not constantly clock watching and thinking, oh, I'm going too fast, or oh, I'm going too slow. It's just, you just go out and do it, and it's way more sociable. You can get big groups. It's less dangerous because the roads in the UK are just carnage. I just love it. Like, I think you're seeing now, like, more and more road runners are running on the trails more and more. And geez, everyone's Sunday long run has always been on the trails. Like, it's what people do. And it's like, okay, well, let's think, like, why are we doing this? And actually, is there any benefit in doing this for other runs? Yes, you need to do the specificity. But easy runs, like, it makes complete sense to do it. You break down the reasons why you run on the trails for your Sunday long run. It's like, okay, well, actually, I can and I should be doing this a little bit more because it transfers across and it translates across really well.
Yeah, it's an absolute no-brainer, man. I just wanted to, before we move on, just touch upon Red Bull a little bit. They do seem to just be a different brand. I mean, when, you know, we were doing a bit of background before the podcast, the Red Bull website came straight up. You're sitting there alongside Trent Alexander-Arnold, I think it was. And it's got a huge profile on you. And I just wonder if, you know, more brands, because I don't know if Adidas have their same profile on you, but, you know, especially in the running world, a lot of brands won't have a profile on any of their athletes. But I could go there. I could learn so much about you, you know, where you've competed, what you've done. And it was kind of like your own Power 10 profile and more on Red Bull. They just do a terrific job in marketing.
I think, yes, it is. You're quite right. They are, I think they care about the athlete and they want to, yes, as well as growing themselves and growing their profile within the sport, they care about the athletes. Like, and I think you look at any other, yeah, you look at any other brand, most 99% of other brands who sponsor runners or partner with runners are running brands, and they'll have 10, 15, 20 athletes that are all pretty similar. Whereas with Red Bull and with Ultra Running, I think there's 4 or 5 of us. So there's not many. But then at the end of the day, you then think Red Bull is an energy drink company. They sell...
This is the crazy thing. How big they are. Yeah.
They sell cans. That's it. Why do they care about the athlete? Why do they want me to be able to perform as well as I can? Why do they want to help me, not just with my physical performance, but with my mental performance? Red Bull pays for my sports psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
How incredible is it that a company who sells energy drinks take this much care and this much attention into their athletes? Like, it's incredible, isn't it? It is revolutionary. And you speak to other athletes who have had sort of very different experiences with brands they've worked in. And for me, I've been so lucky. But during COVID, so many athletes stopped being paid because, oh, you guys aren't racing. And for Red Bull, it was okay, well, yes, you're not racing, but what can we do to help? So Red Bull kitted out our home gym in COVID. Right, you guys can't travel. You guys can't race. What can we do? Like, how often does an athlete get asked by a brand they work with, what can we do to help you?
Wow.
Yeah. It's always a, hi, Tom, how are you? We've got this coming up. Can you do this for us? Can you do that for us? If you have any professional athlete and ask them, how many times has a brand asked, right, what can we do to help?
Yeah.
Mm. And I think it's just that mentality that they care about you as an athlete. Yes, they want to promote what they do, what they're doing, but they care about you. And I think that's where, fundamentally, that's where it comes from. I have Red Bull in the UK have got, I think, 4 athlete managers. Each of them look after 10 athletes. And that's it. That is their job to look after these athletes. It's the dream job because you're mixing with, yes, it might be an ultra runner one day, but yeah, the next day it's, you're on a private jet with Trent, my mate Trent. I've not been on his private jet. I've only met him twice. But also, like, when are you ever in a room with an ultra runner, a professional footballer, a Olympic mountain biker, an Olympic pole vaulter, a skier, a snowboarder, and a big wave surfer having lunch together. The amount of corporate knowledge and shared knowledge that you can learn from these other athletes, it takes, yes, they're not going to be signing athletes who are finishing,
of course,
50th in inter-counties cross-country. But the sort of athletes that they are signing and partnering with, it opens doors to be able to speak to these people. And you can have lunch with the tennis player Dominic Thiam. When I was doing my rehab, so was he. We had 3 weeks of training together. Like, when are you ever going to be able to train with a top 5 seeded tennis player in the world? Yeah. And to see, go through, be able to ask him. Like, I asked him, he was like, how do you do it mentally going out for that long on your own? And I was like, I find it so easy. There's no stress. And I asked him, like, how do you perform when there are thousands and thousands of eyes staring at you? It's you and one other person. I couldn't think of anything worse than that. And he's like, it's just so easy. I find training so hard when I'm on my own. And I'm like, it's crazy how different it is, but the psychology is all still the same. And it's so interesting how much you can learn from these superstars of the sport as an ultra runner in a small sport that you think no one cares about. But you speak to these athletes, they're like, oh yeah, I saw you did this race. Absolutely mental. Like, I tracked it. How did you go for 20 hours? Like, tell me all about it. Like, they care. And it's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating hearing about your experiences there. Look, just before we kind of wrap up, you mentioned you've got your next sort of 5 years in pencil, the next year sort of in stone. What are your goals like for the rest of your career?
Just, you're not, I guess, technically, are you?
So say again?
I said, you're not peaking yet, technically, are you? Because in the world of ultras, is the peak age roughly around about 35? You've got a few more years.
Yeah, exactly. So I think for me, it's being short-term goals, just being consistent. Like, am I going to get injured in the next 5 years? Yes, because slightly it's what happens. But can I train as sensibly and reduce that risk as much as possible? Yes. There are definitely some big ultra-distance trail races that really excite me. So like UTMB, Western States, more in the US, like Hard Rock. All of those races really excite me. There are a couple of projects that I also really excite me that takes out and out performance away from it a little bit. And it's a little bit sort of more storytelling, but challenges. And you take someone like, similar to like Ross Edgley, who's doing some ridiculous swim at the moment, and he swam around Great Britain. Stuff like that, I think, is incredible. And for me, that's what I would love to go into. But you have to earn the right to be able to do that. Like, I'd love to do some sort of fastest known times, solo expeditions, crossing the North Pole the quickest. Things like that really excite me. But in order for me to be able to do that, I've got to win these big races. Yes, I'd love to.
Why so? Just to build up.
Yeah, you've got to
have a stature, you know, have credibility.
And that's it.
Okay.
100%. 100%. And yes, I want to win these big races, but winning a race is amazing, and it's sort of seen as the pinnacle of our sport. But what if your best is not good enough to be the best? What if someone else has a better day than you? You're only racing 3 times a year. So yeah, I want to get the most out of this sport as I possibly can. And I think putting, yes, at Western States next year, the goal very much is to go to break the course record and be the first athlete to ever run sub 14. But it might be really hot and that then becomes impossible. Or I might get a stomach bug the day before. And I've then got to wait another year until I'm able to do it again. So, or someone's better on the day and they run a minute quicker than I do. I still have my best day. So it's so difficult to put a figure, a time, winning races on it. Yes, I'd love to win sort of the biggest 5 races in ultra running. But I think I want to be there and I want to be able to put my name in the hat and get into the ring 3 times a year in the biggest races against the best competition and see where I stack up against them. And I think if I do everything I possibly can, then I think I stack up pretty well. And yeah, you'll win some, you'll lose some, as with everything. But yeah, I want to be as good as I possibly can for as long as I possibly can. And hopefully by that, it inspires people to think, whether it's with ultra running or it's with other races, actually, yes, I've got a stick at it. That's one thing. But let's find a way to make it work, because the conventional way might not work for everyone. And yeah, find a way. Yeah, find something you love. Find a way to be as good at it as you possibly can. Get the most out of it as you possibly can. And yeah, you'll be massively rewarded. Maybe not financially, but you'll just love your life. And yeah, I just think that's way more important for me than winning races.
It's a good take. It sounds like even now you're still not settled. Always.
Looking. I think I love running. Like, I'm one of those weird, sad people, I guess, who just loves running, and I like challenging myself. I don't want to be in my comfort zone. I want to jump into the deep end and see where I stack up against people, because it's running. Like we said earlier, you're trying to get from A to B as quickly as you can. It doesn't matter if it's in a cold, wet, muddy field in Loughborough, or it's in the most beautiful, picturesque mountains in Colorado. Like, it's running. I love both sides of it. Yes, they're different. Physically, they're different. Mentally, they're different. But it's still running. I still feel exactly the same. Yeah, on a muddy field in Prestwold or the most incredible mountains.
Yeah, look, I think that's a great place to end. And thanks so much for coming on the pod. I think Matt and myself have learned a lot, because we're not necessarily the biggest experts on trail running at all. So thank you for that too.
No, absolute pleasure. It's been great fun. And yeah, keep up the good work, guys.